She sympathized with her helpless anxiety, but millions of women were going through the same agonies, and the nobility had a duty to be stoical. I hear you started attending services at the Russian embassy while I was away in France. There was no Russian Orthodox church in London, but there was a chapel in the embassy.
Who told you that?
Never mind who told me. It had been Aunt Herm. Before we married, I asked you to convert to the Church of England, and you did. She would not meet his eye.
I didn't think it would do any harm for me to go to one or two services, she said quietly. I'm so sorry to have displeased you.
Fitz was suspicious of foreign clergymen. Does the priest there tell you it's a sin to take pleasure in lying with your husband?
Of course not. But when you're away and I feel so alone, so far away from everything I grew up with, it's a comfort to me to hear familiar Russian hymns and prayers.
Fitz felt sorry for her. It must be difficult. He certainly could not contemplate going to live permanently in a foreign country, and he knew from conversations with other married men that it was not unusual for a wife to resist her husband's advances after she had borne a child. But he hardened his heart. Everyone had to make sacrifices. Bea should be grateful she did not have to run into machine gun fire. I think I have done my duty by you, he said. When we married, I paid off your family debts. I called in experts, Russian and English, to plan the reorganization of the estates. They had told Andre to drain swamps to produce more farmland and prospect for coal and other minerals, but he had never done anything. It's not my fault that Andre wasted every opportunity.
Yes, Fitz, she said, you did everything you promised.
And I ask that you do your duty. You and I must produce heirs. If Andre dies without fathering children, our son will inherit two huge estates. He will be one of the greatest landowners in the world. We must have more sons in case, God forbid, something should happen to boy. She kept her eyes cast down.
I know my duty.
Fitz felt dishonest. He talked about an heir, and everything he had said was true, but he was not telling her that he hungered to see her soft body spread-eagled for him on the bedsheets, white on white, and her fair hair spilling over the pillow. He repressed the vision. If you know your duty, please do it. Next time I come into your room, I shall expect to be welcomed like the loving husband that I am.
Yes, Fitz.
He left. He was glad he had put his foot down, but he also felt an uneasy sense that he had done something wrong. It was ridiculous. He had pointed out to Bea the error of her ways, and she had accepted his reproof. That was how things ought to be between man and wife. But he could not feel as satisfied as he should. He pushed Bear out of his mind when he met up with Maud and Aunt Herm in the hall. He put on his uniform cap and glanced in the mirror, then quickly looked away. He tried these days not to think much about his appearance. The bullet had damaged the muscles on the left side of his face, and his eyelid had a permanent droop. It was a minor disfigurement, but his vanity would never recover. He told himself to be grateful that his eyesight was unaffected. The blue Cadillac was still in France, but he had managed to get hold of another. His chauffeur knew the way. He had obviously driven Maud to the East End before. Half an hour later they pulled up outside the Calvary Gospel Hall, a mean little chapel with a tin roof. It might have been transplanted from Aberowen. Fitz wondered if the pastor was Welsh. The tea party was already underway and the place was packed with young women and their children. It smelled worse than a barracks, and Fitz had to resist the temptation to hold a handkerchief over his nose. Maud and Herm went to work immediately, Maud seeing women one by one in the back office, and Herm marshalling them. Fitz limped from one table to the next, asking the women where their husbands were serving and what their experiences had been, while their children rolled on the floor. Young women often became giggly and tongue-tied when Fitz spoke to them, but this group was not so easily flustered. They asked him what regiment he served in and how he had got his wounds. It was not until he was halfway round the room that he saw Ethel. He had noticed that there were two offices at the back of the hall, one Maud's, and he had vaguely wondered who was in the second. He happened to look up when the door opened and Ethel stepped out. He had not seen her for 2 years, but she had not changed much. Her dark curls bounced as she walked, and her smile was a sunbeam. Her dress was drab and worn, like the clothes of all the women except Maud and Herm, but she had the same trim figure, and he could not help thinking about the petite body he had known so well. Without even looking at him, she cast her spell. It was as if no time had passed since they had rolled around, giggling and kissing, on the bed in the gardenia suite. She spoke to the only other man in the room, a stooped figure in a dark grey lounge suit of some heavy cloth, sitting at a table making notes in a ledger. He wore thick glasses, but even so Fitz could see the adoration in the man's eyes when he looked up at Ethel. She spoke to him with easy amiability, and Fitz wondered if they were married. Ethel turned around and caught Fitz's eye. Her eyebrows went up and her mouth made an O of surprise. She took a step back, as if nervous, and bumped into a chair. The woman sitting in the chair looked up with an expression of irritation. Ethel mouthed, "Sorry," without looking at her. Fitz rose from his seat, not an easy matter with his busted leg, all the time gazing steadily at Ethel. She dithered visibly, not sure whether to approach him or flee to the safety of her office. He said, "Hello, Ethel." His words did not carry across the noisy room, but she could probably see his lips move and guess what he said. She made a decision and walked toward him. "Good afternoon, Lord Fitzherbert," she said, and her lilting Welsh accent made the routine phrase sound like a melody. She held out her hand and they shook. Her skin was rough. He followed her in reverting to formality. "How are you, Mrs. Williams?" She pulled up a chair and sat down. As he lowered himself into his seat, he realized she had deftly put them on a footing of equality without intimacy. "I seen you at the service in the Aberowan wreck," she said. "I was very sorry." Her voice caught in her throat. She looked down and started again. "I was very sorry to see you wounded. I hope you're getting better." Slowly. He could tell that her concern was genuine. She did not hate him, it seemed, despite everything that had happened. His heart was touched. "How did you get your injuries?" He had told the story so often that it bored him. "It was the first day of the Somme. I hardly saw any fighting. We went over the top, got past our own barbed wire, and started across no man's land. And the next thing I remember is being carried on a stretcher and hurting like hell." "My brother saw you fall." Fitz remembered the insubordinate Corporal William Williams. "Did he? What happened to him?" "His section captured a German trench, then had to abandon it when they ran out of ammunition." Fitz had missed all the debriefing, being in hospital. "Did he get a medal?" "No. The colonel told him he should have defended his position to the death." Billy said, "What, like you did?" And he was put on a charge. Fitz was not surprised. Williams was trouble. "So, what are you doing here?"
"I work with your sister."
"She didn't tell me."
Ethel gave him a level look. "She wouldn't think you'd be interested in news of your former servants."
It was a jibe, but he ignored it.
"What do you do?"
"I'm managing editor of The Soldier's Wife. I arrange printing and distribution and edit the letters page. And I take care of the money." He was impressed. It was a big step up from housekeeper. But she had always been an extraordinarily capable organizer. "My money, I suppose?"
"I don't think so. Maud is careful. She knows you don't mind paying for tea and cake and doctoring for soldiers' children. But she wouldn't use your money for anti-war propaganda."
He kept the conversation going just for the pleasure of watching her face as she talked. "Is that what is in the newspaper?" he asked.
"Anti-war propaganda. We discussed publicly what you speak of only in secret, the possibility of peace."
She was right. Fitz knew that senior politicians in both major parties had been talking about peace, and it angered him. But he did not want to have a row with Ethel. "Your hero, Lloyd George, is in favor of fighting harder. Will he become Prime Minister, do you think?"
"The King doesn't want him, but he may be the only candidate who can unite Parliament. I fear he may prolong the war."
Maud came out of her office. The tea party was breaking up, the women clearing up the cups and saucers and marshalling their children. Fitz marvelled to see Aunt Herm carrying a stack of dirty plates. How the war had changed people. He looked again at Ethel. She was still the most attractive woman he had ever met. He yielded to an impulse. Speaking in a lowered voice, he said, "Will you meet me tomorrow?" She looked shocked.
"What for?"
she said quietly.
"Yes or no?"
"Where?"
"Victoria Station, 1 o'clock, at the entrance to Platform 3.
Before she could reply, the man in thick glasses came over, and Ethel introduced him.
"Earl Fitzherbert, may I present Mr. Bernie Leckwith, chairman of the Aldgate branch of the Independent Labour Party?"
Fitz shook hands. Leckwith was in his 20s. Fitz guessed that poor eyesight had kept him out of the armed forces.
"I'm sorry to say you're wounded, Lord Fitzherbert," Leckwith said in a Cockney accent.
I was one of thousands and lucky to be alive. With hindsight, is there anything we could have done differently at the Somme that would have greatly altered the outcome? Fitz thought for a moment. It was a damned good question. While he considered, Leckwith said, did we need more men and ammunition, as the generals claim? Or more flexible tactics and better communications, as the politicians say? Fitz said thoughtfully, all those things would have helped, but frankly, I don't think they would have brought us victory. The assault was doomed from the start, but we could not possibly have known that in advance. We had to try. Leckwith nodded, as if his own view had been confirmed. I appreciate your candor, he said, almost as if Fitz had made a confession. They left the chapel. Fitz handed Aunt Herm and Maud into the waiting car, then got in himself, and the chauffeur drove away. Fitz found himself breathing hard. He had suffered a small shock. 3 years ago, Ethel had been counting pillowcases at Tŷ Gwyn. Today she was the managing editor of a newspaper that, although small, was considered by senior ministers to be a thorn in the flesh of the government. What was her relationship with the surprisingly intelligent Bernie Leckwith? Who was that chap Leckwith? He asked Maud. An important local politician. Is he Williams's husband? Maud laughed. No, though everyone thinks he should be. He's a clever man who shares her ideals, and he's devoted to her son. I don't know why Ethel didn't marry him years ago. Perhaps he doesn't make her heart beat faster. Maud raised her eyebrows, and Fitz realized he had been dangerously candid. He added hastily, girls of that type want romance, don't they? She'll marry a war hero, not a librarian. She's not a girl of that type or any other type, Maud said rather frostily. She's nothing if not exceptional. You don't meet two like her in a lifetime. Fitz looked away. He knew that was true. He wondered what the child was like. It must have been one of the dirty-faced toddlers playing on the floor of the chapel. He had probably seen his own son this afternoon. He was strangely moved by the thought. For some reason it made him want to cry. The car was passing through Trafalgar Square. He told the driver to stop. I'd better drop in at the office, he explained to Maud. He limped into the old Admiralty building and up the stairs. His desk was in the diplomatic section, which inhabited room 45. Sub-Lieutenant Carver, a student of Latin and Greek, who had come down from Cambridge to help decode German signals, told him that not many intercepts had come in during the afternoon, as usual, and there was nothing he needed to deal with. However, there was some political news. Have you heard? Said Carver. The King has summoned Lloyd George. 2. All the next morning, Ethel told herself she was not going to meet Fitz. How dared he suggest such a thing? For more than 2 years she had heard nothing from him. Then, when they met, he had not even asked about Lloyd, his own child. He was the same selfish, thoughtless deceiver as always. All the same, she had been thrown into a whirl. Fitz had looked at her with his intense green eyes and asked her questions about her life that made her feel she was important to him, contrary to all the evidence. He was no longer the perfect, godlike man he had once been. His beautiful face was marred by one half-closed eye, and he stooped over his walking stick. But his weakness only made her want to take care of him. She told herself she was a fool. He had all the care money could buy. She would not go to meet him. At 12 noon she left the premises of the soldier's wife, two small rooms over a print shop, shared with the Independent Labour Party, and caught a bus. Maud was not at the office that morning, which saved Ethel the trouble of inventing an excuse. It was a long journey by bus and underground train from Aldgate to Victoria, and Ethel arrived at the rendezvous a few minutes after 1 o'clock. She wondered if Fitz might have grown impatient and left, and the thought made her feel slightly ill. But he was there, wearing a tweed suit as if he were going into the country, and she immediately felt better. He smiled. I was afraid you weren't coming, he said. I don't know why I did, she replied. Why did you ask me? I want to show you something. He took her arm. They walked out of the station. Ethel felt foolishly pleased to be arm in arm with Fitz. She wondered at his boldness. He was an easily recognizable figure. What if they ran into one of his friends? She supposed they would pretend not to see one another. In Fitz's social class, a man who had been married a few years was not expected to be faithful. They rode a bus a few stops and got off in the raffish suburb of Chelsea, a low-rent neighborhood of artists and writers. Ethel wondered what he wanted her to see. They walked along a street of small villas. Fitz said, "Have you ever watched a debate in Parliament?"
"No," she said, "but I'd love to."
"You have to be invited by an MP or a peer. Shall I arrange it?"
"Yes, please."
He looked happy that she had accepted. "I'll check when there's going to be something interesting. You might like to see Lloyd George in action."
"Yes."
"He is putting his government together today. I should think he will kiss the King's hand as Prime Minister tonight." Ethel gazed about her thoughtfully. In parts, Chelsea still looked like the country village it had been 100 years ago. The older buildings were cottages and farmhouses, low-built with large gardens and orchards. There was not much greenery in December, but even so the neighbourhood had a pleasant, semi-rural feel.
"Politics is a funny business," she said. "I've wanted Lloyd George for Prime Minister ever since I was old enough to read the newspaper. But now that it's happened, I'm dismayed."
"Why?"
"He's the most belligerent senior figure in the government. His appointment might kill off any chance of peace. On the other hand..."
Fitz looked intrigued.
"What?" "He's the only man who could agree to peace talks without being crucified by Northcliffe's bloodthirsty newspapers."
"That's a point," Fitz said, looking worried. "If anyone else did it, the headlines would scream, 'Fire Asquith,' or 'Balfour,' or 'Bonner Law,' and 'Bring in Lloyd George.' But if they attack Lloyd George, there's no one left. So maybe there is a hope of peace."
He allowed his tone of voice to become testy.
"Why aren't you hoping for victory rather than peace?"
"Because that's how we got into this mess," she said equably. "What are you going to show me?"
"This."
He unlatched a gate and held it open. They entered the grounds of a detached two-story house. The garden was overgrown and the place needed painting, but it was a charming medium-sized home, the kind of place that might be owned by a successful musician, Ethel imagined, or perhaps a well-known actor. Fitz took a key from his pocket and opened the door. They stepped inside and he closed the door and kissed her. She gave herself up to it. She had not been kissed for a long time, and she felt like a thirsty traveller in a desert. She stroked his long neck and pressed her breasts against his chest. She sensed that he was as desperate as she. Before she lost control, she pushed him away.
"Stop," she said breathlessly. "Stop."
"Why?"
"Last time we did this, I ended up talking to your bloody lawyer."
She moved away from him. "I'm not as innocent as I used to be."
"It will be different this time," he said, panting. "I was a fool to let you go. I see that now. I was young, too."
To help her calm down, she looked into the rooms. They were full of dowdy old furniture.
"Whose house is this?" she said.
"Yours," he replied,
"if you want it."
She stared at him. What did he mean?
"You could live here with the baby," he explained. "It was occupied for years by an old lady who used to be my father's housekeeper. She died a few months ago. You could redecorate it and buy new furniture."
"Live here," she said.
"As what?"
He could not quite bring himself to say it.
"As your mistress," she said.
"You can have a nurse and a couple of housemaids and a gardener, even a motor car with a chauffeur, if that appeals to you." The part of it that appealed to her was him. He misinterpreted her thoughtful look.
"Is the house too small? Would you prefer Kensington?
Do you want a butler and a housekeeper? I'll give you anything you want, don't you understand? My life is empty without you." He meant it, she saw. At least he meant it now, when he was aroused and unsatisfied. She knew from bitter experience how fast he could change. The trouble was, she wanted him just as badly. He must have seen that in her face, for he took her in his arms again. She turned up her face to be kissed.
"I want more of this," she thought.
Once again she broke the embrace before she lost control.
"Well,"
he said. She could not make a sensible decision while he was kissing her.
"I've got to be alone," she said.
She forced herself to walk away from him before it was too late.
"I'm going home," she said.
She opened the door. "I need time to think." She hesitated on the doorstep.
"Think as long as you want," he said.
"I'll wait." She closed the door and ran away. 3. Gus Duer was in the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square, standing in front of Rembrandt's self-portrait at the age of 63, when a woman standing next to him said, "Extraordinarily ugly man." Gus turned and was surprised to recognize Maud Fitzherbert. He said, "Me or Rembrandt?" And she laughed. They strolled through the gallery together.
"What a delightful coincidence," he said,
"meeting you here."
"As a matter of fact, I saw you and followed you in," she said. She lowered her voice. I wanted to ask you why the Germans haven't yet made the peace offer you told me was coming. He did not know the answer.
They may have changed their minds, he said gloomily. There, as here, there is a peace faction and a war faction. Perhaps the war faction has gained the upper hand and succeeded in changing the Kaiser's mind.
Surely they must see that battles no longer make a difference, she said with exasperation. Did you read in this morning's papers that the Germans have taken Bucharest?
Gus nodded. Romania had declared war in August, and for a while the British had hoped their new partner might strike a mighty blow. But Germany had invaded back in September, and now the Romanian capital had fallen. In fact, the upshot is good for Germany, which now has Romania's oil.
Exactly, said Maud. It's the same old one step forward, one step back. When will we learn?
The appointment of Lloyd George as Prime Minister isn't encouraging, Gus said.
Ah, there you might be wrong.
Really? He has built his political reputation on being more aggressive than everyone else. It would be hard for him to make peace after that.
Don't be so sure. Lloyd George is unpredictable. He could do a volte-face. It would surprise only those naive enough to have thought him sincere.
Well, that's hopeful.
All the same, I wish we had a woman Prime Minister. Gus did not think that was ever likely to happen, but he did not say so.
There's something else I want to ask you, she said, and she halted.
Gus turned to face her. Perhaps because the paintings had sensitized him, he found himself admiring her face. He noticed the sharp lines of her nose and chin, the high cheekbones, the long neck. The angularity of her features was softened by her full lips and large green eyes.
Anything you like, he said.
What did Walter tell you? Gus's mind went back to that surprising conversation in the bar of the Adlon Hotel in Berlin. He said he was obliged to let me into a secret, but then he didn't tell me what the secret was. He thought you would be able to guess.
I guessed he must be in love with you, and from your reaction when I gave you the letter at Tiguin, I could see that his love is returned.
Gus smiled. If I may say so, he's a lucky man. She nodded, and Gus read something like relief on her face. There must be more to the secret, he realized. That was why she needed to find out how much he knew. He wondered what else they were hiding. Perhaps they were engaged. They walked on.
I understand why he loves you, Gus thought. I could fall for you in a heartbeat.
She surprised him again by suddenly saying, Have you ever been in love, Mr. Dewar?
It was an intrusive question, but he answered anyway.
Yes, I have. Twice. But no longer. He felt an urge to confide in her.
The year the war broke out, I was wicked enough to fall in love with a woman who was already married.
Did she love you?
Yes.
What happened?
I asked her to leave her husband for me. That was very wrong of me, and you will be shocked, I know. But she was a better person than I, and she rejected my immoral offer.
I'm not so easily shocked. When was the second time?
Last year I became engaged to someone in my hometown, Buffalo, but she married someone else.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Perhaps I should not have asked. I have revived a painful memory.
Extremely painful.
Forgive me if I say that makes me feel better. It's just that you know what sorrow love can bring.
Yes, I do.
But perhaps there will be peace after all, and my sorrow will soon be over.
I very much hope so, Lady Maud, said Gus.
4. Ethel agonized for days over Fitz's proposition. As she stood freezing in her backyard, turning the mangle to wring out the washing, she imagined herself in that pretty house in Chelsea, with Lloyd running around the garden, watched over by an attentive nurse.
I'll give you anything you want, Fitz had said, and she knew it was true.
He would put the house in her name. He would take her to Switzerland and the south of France. If she set her mind to it, she could make him give her an annuity, so that she would have an income until she died, even if he got bored with her, although she also knew she could make sure he never got bored. It was shameful and disgusting, she told herself sternly. She would be a woman paid for sex, and what else did the word prostitute mean? She could never invite her parents to her Chelsea hideaway. They would know immediately what it meant. Did she care about that? Perhaps not. But there were other things. She wanted more from life than comfort. As a millionaire's mistress, she would hardly continue to campaign on behalf of working-class women. Her political life would be over. She would lose touch with Bernie and Mildred,
and it would be awkward even to see Maud. But who was she to ask for so much from life? She was Ethel Williams, born in a coal miner's cottage. How could she turn up her nose at a lifetime of ease? You should be so lucky, she told herself, using one of Bernie's sayings. And then there was Lloyd. He would have a governess, and later Fitz would pay for him to go to a posh school. He would grow up among the elite and lead a life of privilege. Did Ethel have the right to deny him that? She was no nearer an answer when she opened the newspapers in the office she shared with Maud and learned of another dramatic offer. On December 12th, the German Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, proposed peace talks with the Allies. Ethel was elated. Peace. Was it really possible? Might Billy come home? The French Premier immediately described the note as a crafty move, and the Russian Foreign Minister denounced the Germans' lying proposals, but Ethel believed it was the British reaction that would count. Lloyd George was not making public speeches of any kind, claiming he had a sore throat. In London in December, half the population had coughs and colds, but all the same, Ethel suspected Lloyd George just wanted time to think. She took that as a good sign. An immediate response would have been a rejection. Anything else was hopeful. He was at least considering peace, she thought optimistically. Meanwhile, President Wilson threw America's weight into the balance on the side of peace. He suggested that, as a preliminary to talks, all the warring powers state their aims, what they were trying to achieve by fighting. "That's embarrassed them," said Bernie Leckwith that evening. "They've forgotten why they started it. They're fighting now just because they want to win." Ethel remembered what Mrs. Diponies had said about the strike. "These men, once they get into a fight, all they care about is winning. They won't give in whatever the cost." She wondered how a woman prime minister might have reacted to a peace proposal. But Bernie was right, she realized over the next few days. President Wilson's suggestion met with a strange silence. No country answered immediately. That made Ethel more angry. How could they carry on if they did not even know what they were fighting for? At the end of the week, Bernie organized a public meeting to debate the German note. On the day of the meeting, Ethel woke up to see her brother standing beside her bed in his khaki uniform. "Billy," she cried, "you're alive?" "And on a week's leave," he said. "Get out of bed, you lazy cow." She jumped up, put on a dressing gown over her nightdress, and hugged him. "Oh, Billy, I'm so happy to see you." She noticed the stripes on his sleeve. "Sergeant now, is it?"
"Aye."
"How did you get into the house?"
"Mildred opened the door. Actually, I've been here since last night."
"Where did you sleep?"
He looked bashful.
"Upstairs."
Ethel grinned.
"Lucky lad. I really like her, Eth."
"So do I,"
Ethel said.
"Mildred is solid gold. Are you going to marry her?"
"Aye, if I survive the war."
"You don't mind about the age difference?"
"She's 23. It's not like she's really old. 30 or something."
"And the children?"
Billy shrugged.
"They're nice kids. But even if they weren't, I'd put up with them for her sake."
"You really do love her. It's not difficult.
She's started a little business. You must have seen all the hats up there in her room."
"Aye, going well too, it is," she says.
"Very well. She's a hard worker. Is Tommy with you?"
"He come over on the boat with me, but now he've gone to Aberowen on the train."
Lloyd woke up, saw a strange man in the room and began to cry. Ethel picked him up and quieted him.
"Come in the kitchen," she said to Billy. "I'll make us some breakfast."
Billy sat and read the paper while she made porridge. After a moment he said,
"Bloody hell."
"What?"
"Bloody Fitzherbert's been opening his big mouth, I see."
He glanced at Lloyd, almost as if the baby might be offended at this scornful reference to his father. Ethel looked over his shoulder. She read, "Peace, a soldier's plea. Don't give up on us now. Wounded Earl speaks out." A moving speech was made yesterday in the House of Lords against the current proposal of the German Chancellor for peace talks. The speaker was Earl Fitzherbert, a major in the Welsh Rifles, who is in London recovering from wounds received at the Battle of the Somme. Lord Fitzherbert said that to talk peace with the Germans would be a betrayal of all the men who have given their lives in the war. "We believe we are winning and can achieve complete victory provided you don't give up on us now," he said. Wearing his uniform, with an eye patch, and leaning on a crutch, the Earl made a striking figure in the debating chamber. He was listened to in absolute silence, and cheered when he sat down. There was a lot more of the same. Ethel was aghast. It was sentimental claptrap, but it would be effective. Fitz did not normally wear the eye patch. He must have put it on for effect. The speech would prejudice a lot of people against the peace plan. She ate breakfast with Billy, then dressed Lloyd and herself and went out. Billy was going to spend the day with Mildred, but he promised to come to the meeting that evening. When Ethel arrived at the office of the soldier's wife, she saw that all the newspapers had reported Fitz's speech. Several made it the subject of a leading article. They took different views, but agreed he had struck a powerful blow. "How can anyone be against the mere discussion of peace?" she said to Maud. "You can ask him yourself," Maud said. "I invited him to tonight's meeting, and he accepted." Ethel was startled. "He'll get a warm reception?" "I certainly hope so." The two women spent the day working on a special edition of the newspaper with the front page headline, "Small Danger of Peace." Maud liked the irony, but Ethel thought it was too subtle. Late in the afternoon, Ethel collected Lloyd from the childminder, took him home, fed him, and put him to bed. She left him in the care of Mildred, who did not go to political meetings. The Calvary Gospel Hall was filling up when Ethel arrived, and soon there was standing room only. The audience included many soldiers and sailors in uniform. Bernie chaired the meeting. He opened with a speech of his own that managed to be dull, even though short. He was no orator. Then he called on the first speaker, a philosopher from Oxford University. Ethel knew the arguments for peace better than the philosopher did, and as he spoke, she studied the two men on the platform who were wooing her. Fitz was the product of hundreds of years of wealth and culture. As always, he was beautifully dressed, his hair well cut, his hands white, and his fingernails clean. Bernie came from a tribe of persecuted nomads who survived by being cleverer than those who tormented them. He was wearing his only suit, the heavy dark grey serge. Ethel had never seen him in anything else. When the weather was warm, he simply took off the jacket. The audience listened quietly. The labor movement was divided over peace. Ramsay MacDonald, who had spoken against the war in Parliament on August 3, 1914, had resigned as Labour Party leader when war was declared 2 days later, and since then the party's MPs had supported the war, as did most of their voters. But Labour supporters tended to be the most sceptical of working-class people, and there was a strong minority in favour of peace. Fitz began by speaking of Britain's proud traditions. "For hundreds of years," he said, "Britain had maintained the balance of power in Europe, generally by siding with weaker nations to make sure no one country dominated. The German Chancellor has not said anything about the terms of a peace settlement, but any discussion would have to start from the status quo," he said. "Peace now means that France is humiliated and robbed of territory, and Belgium becomes a satellite. Germany would dominate the continent by sheer military force. We cannot allow that to happen. We must fight for victory." When the discussion opened, Bernie said, "Earl Fitzherbert is here in a purely personal capacity, not as an army officer, and he has given me his word of honour that serving soldiers in the audience will not be disciplined for anything they say. Indeed, we would not have invited the Earl to attend the meeting on any other basis." Bernie himself asked the first question. As usual, it was a good one. "If France is humiliated and loses territory, then that will destabilise Europe, according to your analysis, Lord Fitzherbert." Fitz nodded. "Whereas if Germany is humiliated and loses the territories of Alsace and Lorraine, as she undoubtedly would, then that will stabilise Europe." Fitz was momentarily stumped, Ethel could see. He had not expected to have to deal with such a sharp opposition here in the East End. Intellectually, he was no match for Bernie. She felt a bit sorry for him. "Why the difference?" Bernie finished, and there was a murmur of approval from the peace faction in the audience. Fitz recovered rapidly. "The difference," he said, "is that Germany is the aggressor, brutal, militaristic, and cruel, and if we make peace now, we will be rewarding that behaviour and encouraging it in the future." That brought a cheer from the other section of the audience, and Fitz's face was saved. But it was a poor argument, Ethel thought, and Maud stood up to say so. "The outbreak of war was not the fault of any single nation," she said. "It has become the conventional wisdom to blame Germany, and our militaristic newspapers encourage this fairy tale. We remember Germany's invasion of Belgium and talk as if it was completely unprovoked. We have forgotten the mobilization of 6 million Russian soldiers on Germany's border. We have forgotten the French refusal to declare neutrality." A few men booed her. "You never get cheered for telling people the situation is not as simple as they think," Ethel reflected wryly.
I don't say Germany is innocent, Maud protested. I say no country is innocent. I say we are not fighting for the stability of Europe, or for justice for the Belgians, or to punish German militarism. We are fighting because we are too proud to admit we made a mistake.
A soldier in uniform stood up to speak, and Ethel saw with pride that it was Billy.
I fought at the Somme, he began, and the audience went quiet. I want to tell you why we lost so many men there.
Ethel heard their father's strong voice and quiet conviction, and she realized Billy would have made a great preacher.
We were told by our officers,
here he stretched out his arm and pointed an accusing finger at Fitz, that the assault would be a walk in the park. Ethel saw Fitz shift uncomfortably in his chair on the platform.
Billy went on. We were told that our artillery had destroyed the enemy positions, wrecked their trenches and demolished their dugouts, and when we got to the other side, we would see nothing but dead Germans.
He was not addressing the people on the platform, Ethel observed, but looking all around him, sweeping the audience with an intense gaze, making sure all eyes were on him.
Why did they tell us those things?
Billy said, and now he looked straight at Fitz and spoke with deliberate emphasis.
Things that were not true.
There was a mutter of agreement from the audience. Ethel saw Fitz's face darken. She knew that for men of Fitz's class, an accusation of lying was the worst of all insults. Billy knew it, too.
Billy said, the German positions had not been destroyed, as we discovered when we ran into machine gun fire.
The audience reaction became less muted. Someone called out, shame! Fitz stood up to speak, but Bernie said,
one moment, please, Lord Fitzherbert, let the present speaker finish.
Fitz sat down, shaking his head vigorously from side to side. Billy raised his voice.
Did our officers check by aerial reconnaissance and by sending out patrols how much damage the artillery had in fact done to the German lines? If not, why not?
Fitz stood up again, furious. Some of the audience cheered, others booed. He began to speak.
You don't understand, he said. But Billy's voice prevailed. If they knew the truth, he cried, why did they tell us otherwise?
Fitz began to shout, and half the audience were calling out. But Billy's voice could be heard over everything else.
I ask one simple question, he roared. Are our officers fools or liars?
5. Ethel received a letter in Fitz's large, confident handwriting on his expensive, crested notepaper. He did not mention the meeting in Aldgate, but invited her to the Palace of Westminster on the following day, Tuesday, December 19th, to sit in the gallery of the House of Commons and hear Lloyd George's first speech as Prime Minister. She was excited. She had never thought she would see the inside of Westminster Palace, let alone hear her hero speak.
"What do you suppose he's invited you?"
said Bernie that evening, asking the key question as usual. Ethel did not have a plausible answer. Sheer unadulterated kindness had never been part of Fitz's character. He could be generous when it suited him. Bernie was shrewdly wondering if he wanted something in return. Bernie was cerebral rather than intuitive, but he had sensed some connection between Fitz and Ethel, and he had responded by becoming a bit amorous. It was nothing dramatic, for Bernie was not a dramatic man, but he held her hand an instant longer than he should have, stood an inch closer to her than was comfortable, patted her shoulder when speaking to her, and held her elbow as she went down a step. Suddenly insecure, Bernie was instinctively making gestures that said she belonged to him. Unfortunately, she found it hard not to flinch when he did so. Fitz had reminded her cruelly of what she did not feel about Bernie. Maud came into the office at 10:30 on Tuesday, and they worked side by side all morning. Maud could not write the front page of the next edition until Lloyd George had spoken, but there was a lot else in the paper. Jobs, advertisements for childminders, advice on women's and children's health, written by Dr. Greenwood, recipes, and letters.
Fitz is beside himself with rage after that meeting, Maud said. I told you they would give him a hard time.
He doesn't mind that, she said, but Billy called him a liar.
You're sure it's not just that Billy got the better of the argument?
Maud smiled ruefully.
Perhaps. I just hope he doesn't make Billy suffer for it.
He won't do that, Maud said firmly. It would be breaking his word.
Good.
They had lunch in a cafe in the Mile End Road. A good pull-in for carmen, according to its signboard, and it was indeed full of lorry drivers. Maud was greeted cheerfully by the counter-staff. They had beef and oyster pie, the cheap oysters added to eke out the scarce beef. Afterward, they took a bus across London to the West End. Ethel looked up at the giant dial of Big Ben and saw that it was 3:30. Lloyd George was due to speak at 4. He had it in his power to end the war and save millions of lives. Would he do it? Lloyd George had always fought for the working man. Before the war, he had done battle with the House of Lords and the King to bring in old age pensions. Ethel knew how much that meant to penniless old people. On the first day the pension was paid out, she had seen retired miners, once strong men now bent and trembling, come out of the Aberowen post office openly weeping for joy that they were no longer destitute. That was when Lloyd George had become a working-class hero. The Lords had wanted to spend the money on the Royal Navy. "I could write his speech today," she thought. "I would say, there are moments in the life of a man and of a nation when it is right to say, I have done my utmost, and I can do no more. Therefore I will cease my striving and seek another road. Within the last hour I have ordered a ceasefire along the entire length of the British line in France. Gentlemen, the guns have fallen silent." It could be done. The French would be furious, but they would have to join in the ceasefire, or take the risk that Britain might make a separate peace and leave them to certain defeat. The peace settlement would be hard on France and Belgium, but not as hard as the loss of millions more lives. It would be an act of great statesmanship. It would also be the end of Lloyd George's political career. Voters would not elect the man who lost the war. But what a way to go out. Fitz was waiting in the central lobby. Gus Duer was with him. No doubt he was as eager as everyone else to find out how Lloyd George would respond to the peace initiative. They climbed the long staircase to the gallery and took their seats overlooking the debating chamber. Ethel had Fitz on her right and Gus on her left. Below them, the rows of green leather benches on both sides were already full of MPs, except for the few places in the front row traditionally reserved for the cabinet. "Every MP a man," Maud said loudly. An usher, wearing full formal court dress, complete with velvet knee breeches and white stockings, officially hissed, "Quiet, please." A backbencher was on his feet, but hardly anyone was listening to him. They were all waiting for the new Prime Minister. Fitz spoke quietly to Ethel. "Your brother insulted me."
"You poor thing," Ethel said sarcastically. "Are your feelings hurt? Men used to fight duels for less. Now there's a sensible idea for the 20th century."
He was unmoved by her scorn. "Does he know who is the father of Lloyd?" Ethel hesitated, not wanting to tell him, but reluctant to lie. Her hesitation told him what he wanted to know.
"I see," he said.
"That would explain his vituperation."
"I don't think you need to look for an ulterior motive," she said. "What happened at the Somme is enough to make soldiers angry, don't you think? He should be court-martialed for insolence."
"But you promised not to—"
"Yes,"
he said crossly. "Unfortunately, I did." Lloyd George entered the chamber. He was a small, slight figure in formal morning dress, the overlong hair a bit unkempt, the busy moustache now entirely white. He was 53. But there was a spring in his step, and as he sat down and said something to a backbencher, Ethel saw the grin familiar from newspaper photographs. He began speaking at 4:10. His voice was a little hoarse, and he said he had had a sore throat. He paused, then said,
"I appear before the House of Commons today with the most terrible responsibility that can fall on the shoulders of any living man."
That was a good start, Ethel thought. At least he was not going to dismiss the German note as an unimportant trick or diversion in the way the French and Russians had.
"Any man or set of men who wantonly or without sufficient cause prolonged a terrible conflict like this would have on his soul a crime that oceans could not cleanse."
That was a biblical touch, Ethel thought, a Baptist chapel reference to sins being washed away. But then, like a preacher, he made the contrary statement.
"Any man or set of men who, out of a sense of weariness or despair, abandoned the struggle without the high purpose for which we had entered into it being nearly fulfilled, would have been guilty of the costliest act of poltroonery ever perpetrated by any statesman."
Ethel fidgeted anxiously. Which way was he going to jump? She thought of telegram day in Aberowen, and saw again the faces of the bereaved. Surely Lloyd George, of all politicians, would not let heartbreak of that nature continue if he could help it. If he did, what was the point of his being in politics at all? He quoted Abraham Lincoln, "We accepted this war for an object, and a worthy object.
and the war will end when that object is attained. That was ominous. Ethel wanted to ask him what the object was. Woodrow Wilson had asked that question and, as yet, had got no reply. No answer was given now. Lloyd George said, "Are we likely to achieve that object by accepting the invitation of the German Chancellor? That is the only question we have to put to ourselves." Ethel felt frustrated. How could this question be discussed if no one knew what the object of the war was? Lloyd George raised his voice, like a preacher about to speak of hell. "To enter at the invitation of Germany, proclaiming herself victorious, without any knowledge of the proposal she proposes to make, into a conference." Here he paused, and looked around the chamber, first to the Liberals behind him and to his right, then across the floor to the Conservatives on the opposition side, "is to put our heads into a noose with the rope end in the hands of Germany." There was a roar of approval from the MPs. He was rejecting the peace offer. Beside Ethel, Gus Dewar buried his face in his hands. Ethel said loudly, "What about Alan Pritchard, killed at the Somme?" The usher said, "Quiet there." Ethel stood up. "Sergeant Prophet Jones, dead?" she cried. Fitz said, "Be quiet and sit down, for God's sake." Down in the chamber, Lloyd George continued speaking, though one or two MPs were looking up at the gallery. "Clive Pugh!" she shouted at the top of her voice. Two ushers came toward her, one from each side. "Spotty Llewellyn!" The ushers grabbed her arms and hustled her away. "Joey Ponty!" she screamed, and they dragged her out through the door. Chapter 22. January and February 1917. Walter Ulrich dreamed he was in a horse-drawn carriage on his way to meet Maud. The carriage was going downhill and began to travel dangerously fast, bouncing on the uneven road surface. He shouted, "Slow down, slow down!" But the driver could not hear him over the drumming of hooves, which sounded oddly like the running of a motor car engine. Despite this anomaly, Walter was terrified that the runaway carriage would crash and he would never reach Maud. He tried again to order the driver to slow down, and the effort of shouting woke him. In reality, he was in an automobile, a chauffeur-driven Mercedes 3795 double phaeton, travelling at moderate speed along a bumpy road in Silesia. His father sat beside him smoking a cigar. They had left Berlin in the early hours of the morning, both wrapped in fur coats. It was an open car, and they were on their way to the eastern headquarters of the High Command. The dream was easy to interpret. The Allies had scornfully rejected the peace offer that Walter had worked so hard to promote. The rejection had strengthened the hand of the German military, who wanted to resume unrestricted submarine warfare, sinking every ship in the war zone, military or civilian, passenger or freight, combatant or neutral, in order to starve Britain and France into submission. The politicians, notably the Chancellor, feared that was the way to defeat, for it was likely to bring the United States into the war. But the submariners were winning the argument. The Kaiser had shown which way he leaned by promoting the aggressive Arthur Zimmermann to foreign minister, and Walter dreamed of charging downhill to disaster. Walter believed that the greatest danger to Germany was the United States. The aim of German policy should be to keep America out of the war. True, Germany was being starved by the Allied naval blockade, but the Russians could not last much longer, and when they capitulated, Germany would overrun the rich western and southern regions of the Russian Empire, with their vast cornfields and bottomless oil wells, and the entire German army would then be able to concentrate on the Western Front. That was the only hope. But when would the Kaiser see that? The final decision would be made today. A bleak winter daylight was breaking over countryside patchworked with snow. Walter felt like a shirker, being so far from the fighting. "I should have returned to the front line weeks ago," he said. "Clearly the army wants you in Germany," said Otto. "You are valued as an intelligence analyst. Germany is full of older men who could do the job at least as well as I. Have you pulled strings?" Otto shrugged. "I think if you were to marry and have a son, you could then be transferred anywhere you like." Walter said incredulously, "You're keeping me in Berlin to make me marry Monica von der Helbart?" "I don't have the power to do that, but it may be that there are men in the High Command who understand the need to maintain noble bloodlines." That was disingenuous, and a protest came to Walter's lips,
But then the car turned off the road, passed through an ornamental gateway, and started up a long drive, flanked by leafless trees and snow-covered lawn. At the end of the drive was a huge house, the largest Walter had ever seen in Germany.
"Castle Pless," he said. "Correct. It's vast. 300 rooms."
They got out of the car and entered a hall, like a railway station. The walls were decorated with boars' heads framed with red silk, and a massive marble staircase led up to the staterooms on the first floor. Walter had spent half his life in splendid buildings, but this was exceptional. A general approached them, and Walter recognized von Henscher, a crony of his father's.
"You've got time to wash and brush up if you're quick," he said with amiable urgency. "You're expected in the state dining room in 40 minutes.
He looked at Walter. "This must be your son."
Otto said, "He's in the intelligence department."
Walter gave a brisk salute.
"I know. I put his name on the list."
The general addressed Walter.
"I believe you know America."
"I spent 3 years in our embassy in Washington, sir."
"Good. I have never been to the United States. Nor has your father. Nor indeed have most of the men here, with the notable exception of our new foreign minister."
20 years ago, Arthur Zimmermann had returned to Germany from China via the States, crossing from San Francisco to New York by train, and on the basis of this experience was considered an expert on America. Walter said nothing.
Von Henscher said, "Herr Zimmermann has asked me to consult you both on something."
Walter was flattered but puzzled. Why would the new foreign minister want his opinion?
"But we will have more time for that later."
Von Henscher beckoned to a footman in old-fashioned livery who showed them to a bedroom. Half an hour later they were in the dining room, now converted to a conference room. Looking around, Walter was awestruck to see that just about every man who counted for anything in Germany was present, including the Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, his close-cropped hair now almost white at age 60. Most of Germany's senior military commanders were sitting around a long table. For lesser men, including Walter, there were rows of hard chairs against the wall. An aide passed around a few copies of a 200-page memorandum. Walter looked over his father's shoulder at the file. He saw charts of tonnage moving in and out of British ports, tables of freight rates and cargo space, the calorific value of British meals, even a calculation of how much wool there was in a lady's skirt. They waited 2 hours, then Kaiser Wilhelm came in, wearing a general's uniform. Everyone sprang to their feet. His Majesty looked pale and ill-tempered. He was a few days from his 58th birthday. As ever, he held his withered left arm motionless at his side, attempting to make it inconspicuous. Walter found it difficult to summon up that emotion of joyous loyalty that had come so easily to him as a boy. He could no longer pretend the Kaiser was the wise father of his people. Wilhelm II was too obviously an unexceptional man, completely overwhelmed by events. Incompetent, bewildered, and miserably unhappy, he was a standing argument against hereditary monarchy. The Kaiser looked around, nodding to one or two special favorites, including Otto. Then he sat down and made a gesture at Henning von Holstendorf, white-bearded chief of the Admiralty staff. The Admiral began to speak, quoting from his memorandum. The number of submarines the Navy could maintain at sea at any one time, the tonnage of shipping required to keep the Allies alive, and the speed at which they could replace sunk vessels.
"I calculate we can sink 600,000 tons of shipping per month," he said.
It was an impressive performance, every statement backed up by a number. Walter was skeptical only because the Admiral was too precise, too certain. Surely war was never that predictable. Von Holzendorf pointed to a ribbon-tied document on the table, presumably the Imperial order to begin unrestricted submarine warfare.
"If Your Majesty approves my plan today, I guarantee the Allies will capitulate in precisely 5 months."
He sat down. The Kaiser looked at the Chancellor. Now, Walter thought, we will hear a more realistic assessment. Bethmann had been Chancellor for 7 years, and unlike the monarch, he had a sense of the complexity of international relations. Bethmann spoke gloomily of American entry into the war and the USA's uncounted resources of manpower, supplies, and money. In his support, he quoted the opinions of every senior German who was familiar with the United States. but to Walter's disappointment, he looked like a man going through the motions. He must believe the Kaiser had already made up his mind. Was this meeting merely to ratify a decision already taken? Was Germany doomed? The Kaiser had a short attention span for people who disagreed with him, and while his Chancellor was speaking, he fidgeted, grunting impatiently, and making disapproving faces. Bettmann began to dither. If the military authorities consider the U-boat war essential, I am not in a position to contradict them. On the other hand, he never got to say what was on the other hand. Von Holzendorf jumped to his feet and interrupted. I guarantee on my word as a naval officer that no American will set foot upon the continent, he said. That was absurd, Walter thought. What did his word as a naval officer have to do with anything? But it went down better than all his statistics. The Kaiser brightened, and several other men nodded approval. Bettmann seemed to give up. His body slumped in the chair. The tension went out of his face, and he spoke in a defeated voice. If success beckons, we must follow, he said. The Kaiser made a gesture, and von Holzendorf pushed the beribboned document across the table. No, Walter thought. We can't possibly make this fateful decision on such inadequate grounds. The Kaiser picked up a pen and signed Wilhelm I.R. He put down the pen and stood up. Everyone in the room jumped to his feet. This can't be the end, Walter thought. The Kaiser left the room. The tension was broken and a buzz of talk broke out. Bettmann remained in his seat, staring down at the table. He looked like a man who has met his doom. He was muttering something and Walter stepped closer to hear. It was a Latin phrase. Finis Germaniae, the end of the Germans. General von Henscher appeared and said to Otto, If you would care to come with me, we will have lunch privately. You too, young men. He led them into a side room where a cold buffet was laid out. Castle Pless served as a residence for the Kaiser, so the food was good. Walter was angry and depressed, but like everyone else in Germany, he was hungry, and he piled his plate high with cold chicken, potato salad, and white bread. Today's decision was anticipated by Foreign Minister Zimmermann, said von Henscher. He wants to know what we can do to discourage the Americans. Small chance of that, Walter thought. If we sink American ships and drown American citizens, there's not much we can do to soften the blow. The general went on, Can we, for example, foment a protest movement among the 1.3 million Americans who were born here in Germany? Walter groaned inwardly. Absolutely not, he said. It's a stupid fairy tale. His father snapped, Careful how you speak to your superiors. Von Henscher made a calming gesture. Let the boy speak his mind, Otto. I might as well have his frank opinion. Why do you say that, Major? Walter said, They don't love the fatherland. Why do you think they left? They may eat wurst and drink beer, but they're Americans, and they'll fight for America. What about the Irish-born? Same thing. They hate the British, of course, but when our submarines kill Americans, they'll hate us more. Otto said irritably, How can President Wilson declare war on us? He has just won re-election as the man who kept America out of war. Walter shrugged. In some ways that makes it easier. People will believe he had no option. Von Henscher said, What might hold him back? Protection for ships of neutral countries. Out of the question, his father interrupted. Unrestricted means unrestricted. That's what the Navy wanted, and that's what His Majesty has given them. Von Henscher said, If domestic issues aren't likely to trouble Wilson, is there any chance he may be distracted by foreign affairs in his own hemisphere? He turned to Otto. Mexico, for example. Otto smiled, looking pleased. You're remembering the Iberanga. I must admit that was a small triumph of aggressive diplomacy. Walter had never shared his father's glee over the incident of the shipload of arms sent by Germany to Mexico. Otto and his cronies had made President Wilson look foolish, and they could yet come to regret it. And now, said von Henscher, most of the U.S. Army is either in Mexico or stationed on the border, said Walter. Ostensibly, they're chasing a bandit called Pancho Villa, who raids across the border. President Carranza is bursting with indignation at the violation of his sovereign territory, but there isn't much he can do. If he had help from us,
Would that change anything? Walter considered. This kind of diplomatic mischief-making struck him as risky, but it was his duty to answer the questions as accurately as he could. The Mexicans feel they were robbed of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. They have a dream of winning those territories back, much like the French pipe dream of winning back Alsace and Lorraine. President Carranza may be stupid enough to believe it could be done. Otto said eagerly, in any event, the attempt would certainly take American attention away from Europe. For a while, Walter agreed reluctantly, in the long term our interference might strengthen those Americans who would like to join in the war on the Allied side. The short term is what interests us. You heard von Holzendorf. Our submarines are going to bring the Allies to their knees in 5 months. All we want is to keep the Americans busy that long. Von Henscher said, what about Japan? Is there any chance the Japs might be persuaded to attack the Panama Canal or even California? Realistically, no, Walter said firmly. The discussion was venturing farther into the land of fantasy. But Von Henscher persisted. Nevertheless, the mere threat might tie up more American troops on the West Coast. I suppose it could, yes. Otto patted his lips with his napkin. This is all most interesting, but I must see whether His Majesty needs me. They all stood up. Walter said, if I may say so, General. His father sighed, but Von Henscher said, please. I believe all this is very dangerous, sir. If word got out that German leaders were even talking about fomenting strife in Mexico and encouraging Japanese aggression in California, American public opinion would be so outraged that the declaration of war would come much sooner, if not immediately. Forgive me if I am stating the obvious, but this conversation should remain highly secret. Quite all right, said Von Henscher. He smiled at Otto. Your father and I are the older generation, of course, but we still know a thing or two. You may rely on our discretion. 2. Fitz was pleased that the German peace proposal had been spurned, and proud of his part in the process, but when it was over he had doubts. He thought it over, walking, or rather limping, along Piccadilly on the morning of Wednesday, January 17th, on his way to his office in the Admiralty. Peace talks would have been a sneaky way for the Germans to consolidate their gains, legitimizing their hold over Belgium, northeastern France, and parts of Russia. For Britain to take part in such talks would have amounted to an admission of defeat, but Britain still had not won. Lloyd George's talk of a knockout went down well in the newspapers, but all sensible people knew it was a daydream. The war would go on, perhaps for a year, perhaps longer, and if the Americans continued to remain neutral, it might end in peace talks after all. What if no one could win this war? Another million men would be killed for no purpose. The thought that haunted Fitz was that Ethel might have been right after all. And what if Britain lost? There would be a financial crisis, unemployment, and destitution. Working-class men would take up Ethel's father's cry and say that they had never been allowed to vote for the war. The people's rage against their rulers would be boundless. Protests and marches would turn into riots. It was only a little over a century ago that Parisians had executed their king and much of the nobility. Would Londoners do the same? Fitz imagined himself, bound hand and foot, carried on a cart to the place of execution, spat upon and jeered at by the crowd. Worse, he saw the same happening to Maud and Aunt Herm and Bear and Boy. He pushed the nightmare out of his mind. What a little spitfire Ethel was, he thought with mingled admiration and regret. He had been mortified with embarrassment when his guest was ejected from the gallery during Lloyd George's speech, but at the same time he found himself even more attracted to her. Unfortunately, she had turned against him. He had followed her out and caught up with her in the central lobby, and she had berated him, blaming him and his kind for prolonging the war. From the way she talked, you would think every soldier who died in France had been killed by Fitz personally. That was the end of his Chelsea scheme. He had sent her a couple of notes, but she had not replied. The disappointment hit him hard. When he thought of the delightful afternoons they might have spent in that love nest, he felt the loss like an ache in his chest. However, he had some consolation. Bea had taken his reprimand to heart. She now welcomed him to her bedroom, dressed in pretty nightwear.
offering him her scented body, as she had when they were first married. In the end, she was a well-brought-up aristocratic woman, and she knew what a wife was for. Musing on the compliant princess and the irresistible activist, he entered the old Admiralty building to find a partly decoded German telegram on his desk. It was headed, Berlin zu Washington, W158, 16th January 1917. Fitz looked automatically at the foot of the decrypt to see who it was from. The name at the end was Zimmermann. His interest was piqued. This was a message from the German foreign minister to his ambassador in the United States. With a pencil, Fitz wrote a translation, putting squiggles and question marks where code groups had not been decrypted. Most secret for your excellency's personal information and to be handed on to the imperial minister. Question mark, Mexico, question mark, with XXXX by a safe route. The question marks indicated a code group whose meaning was not certain. The decoders were guessing. If they were right, this message was for the German ambassador in Mexico. It was simply being sent via the Washington embassy. Mexico, Fitz thought. How odd. The next sentence was completely decoded. We propose to begin on 1st February unrestricted submarine warfare. My God, Fitz said aloud. It was fearfully expected, but this was firm confirmation, and with a date. The news would be a coup for Room 40. In doing so, however, we shall endeavor to keep America neutral, XXXX. If we should not, we propose to, question mark, Mexico, question mark, an alliance upon the following basis. Conduct of war, conclusion of peace. An alliance with Mexico? Fitz said to himself. This is strong stuff. The Americans are going to be hopping mad. Your Excellency should, for the present, inform the President secretly, war with the USA, XXXX, and at the same time to negotiate between us and Japan, XXXX. Our submarines will compel England to peace within a few months. Acknowledge receipt. Fitz looked up and caught the eye of young Carver, who, he now saw, was bursting with excitement. You must be reading the Zimmermann intercept, the sub-lieutenant said. Such as it is, Fitz said calmly. He was just as euphoric as Carver, but better at concealing it. Why is the decrypt so scrappy? It's in a new code that we haven't completely cracked. All the same, the message is hot stuff, isn't it? Fitz looked again at his translation. Carver was not exaggerating. This appeared very much like an attempt to get Mexico to ally with Germany against the United States. It was sensational. It might even make the American president angry enough to declare war on Germany. Fitz's pulse quickened. I agree, he said, and I'm going to take this straight to Blinker Hall. Captain William Reginald Hall, the director of naval intelligence, had a chronic facial tic, hence the nickname, but there was nothing wrong with his brain. He will ask questions, and I need to have some answers.